Arise. Oi. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw an eye and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. This is the matter of Osceola versus Secretary Peak. Our counsel is ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right. Before we proceed, I'm going to recognize Mrs. Cynthia Brandinano.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Cynthia Brandon Arnold, and I'm pleased today to move the admission of Jason S. Greenwood, Esquire of Washington, D.C., to the bar of this honorable court. I'm satisfied that Mr. Greenwood possesses the necessary qualifications. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Greenwood, please step forward. The clerk, please administer the oath of office.
Mr. Greenwood, do you solemnly swear that you will conduct yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Greenwood, welcome to the bar.
Thank you, sir.
We look forward to the opportunity to have you come before us and in the representation of veterans of the armed forces. We wish you very well in your practice, and feel free to come and visit the court at any time.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Jackson, you have 30 minutes to have your argument. Do you wish to reserve any of that time for rebuttal?
If I may, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
5 minutes for rebuttal. Are you ready to proceed?
I am.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Green, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Francis Jackson. I'm here representing Mr. Osceola. As you know, this is a CUE claim arising from the RO's failure to award service connection for multiple sclerosis.
Excuse me, Mr. Jackson.
Yes,
some of us are a little hard of hearing. Could I get you to adjust that?
I'll do my best, Your Honor. Is that any better?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. As I was saying, Your Honor, the claim arises from the RO's failure to award service connection for multiple sclerosis despite some symptoms during Mr. Osceola's period of active duty for training in 1989 and further periods of duty from 1990 to 1995. He was specifically diagnosed with MS by an Army doctor while still in the reserves in 1995 and originally sought service connection in 1998, which
Mr.
was
Jackson,
denied.
Yes, excuse me. Did the RO in this case decide the question of direct service connection?
They did not, Your Honor.
They did not?
They did not. What the RO did, Your Honor, was to focus on the question of whether there was a presumption arising under 3.307. The CUE pleadings filed by DAV in 2000, in 2003, point out that the original RO finding simply said that there was no evidence that the veteran's MS originated during the period of qualifying military service. It's no more specific than that, Your Honor. It didn't talk about direct service connection in any more formal way than that.
Well,
and, yes, sir.
Are you familiar with the RO decision?
Yes, sir.
Under its reasons and base or basis, it did refer to the section you just referred to.
Yes, sir.
And then later on in the reasons and basis, it refers specifically to 3.309 and 3.307.
Yes, sir.
Elements.
It does.
So do you see that as being two distinct discussions?
Your Honor, it seemed to me that the RO's focus was on the presumptive issue. It did not appear to me that there was a specific determination of the direct service connection issue.
Okay, and even though the board did not address, in your argument, direct service connection.
Yes, sir.
Did the motion for Q address itself specifically to the presumptive?
addressed, it addressed that largely, Your Honor. The, as you know from the record, I'm sure, the wording is fairly vague, but it does focus heavily on the presumptive issue, but it cites both 3.303 and 1131, which include, as you know, direct service connection. And I would point out, Your Honor, that on the way, if you will, to the BVA, Mr. Asciola, in this case, filed a handwritten Form 9 that was submitted under cover letter from the DAV, and in that he specifically cites 3.303. In fact, if you look at that document, someone went back and inserted that. The original reading, the original writing, excuse me, says 3.307 and 3.309, but he went back and put a little caret and wrote in 3.303. And again, as you know, Your Honor, when we're talking about what someone filed pro se, that's entitled under even Andrews to a very sympathetic reading.
Counsel, do you have a record reference for that document?
I do, Your Honor. That would be at 139, I believe, Your Honor. Sorry, 140. 139 is the cover letter. And if you look at the bottom of that page, Your Honor, in the box, it says, I have meet all the requirements pertaining to the regulations stated in 38 CFR. And there's a little caret, 3.303, and then it goes on, 3.304. And the MS that I have is covered under 38 CFR 3.307.
Counselor, is that specific enough to articulate a Q theory?
Your Honor, I think it has to be. And the reason I think it has to be is because of a case that I didn't even talk about in my supplemental memorandum. It's Robinson, which I understand you were on the panel. in Robinson, what this court said in the majority opinion is that the VA's practice is to read all the pleadings sympathetically, notwithstanding Andrews. The Schroeder v. West doesn't require the VA to explicitly discuss particular theories sua sponte, but that even if a claim is represented, the VA must consider all the issues reasonably raised either by the claimant or the evidence of record. It goes on to talk about construing the arguments liberally under 20.202, adjudicating all the issues reasonably raised by a liberal reading of the substantive appeal, and I stress that, the substantive appeal, which is the form we were just talking about, and discussing...
Let me interrupt you a minute, because
yes,
I think what we've got is a gap, a big gap.
Certainly.
That there needs to be a bridge between perhaps here and to the Federal Circuit.
Certainly.
Because what you're just referring to are principles of our jurisprudence that deals with the adjudication or the expected adjudication of claims at the RO and the board level.
Yes, sir.
Original claims.
Yes, sir.
And somehow you're saying that Robertson or Roberson, however you want to cite it, has now applied those principles to the jurisprudence concern governing Q motions.
Your Honor, I was actually suggesting that this court's decision in Robinson earlier this year, in which Judge Hagel was on the panel.
Okay.
Judge Lance was on the panel, and Judge Hagel wrote, makes that bridge. And I was pointing out that in Robinson, this court said that the VA must construe all the arguments in a liberal manner under 20.202 in Urban, adjudicate all the issues reasonably raised by a liberal reading of this substantive appeal, including all documents and testimony, citing Brandon, and discussing the relevant evidence, citing Dela Cruz. And the reason I'm talking about Robinson is after reading opposing counsel's memorandum, I went back and reread Robinson. And originally I kind of skipped over Robinson Originally I kind of skipped over Robinson because it didn't deal with an unrepresented claimant. But Robinson, I think, actually is more significant than I originally realized, because if those are the standards when you are represented, that is to say, the VA has to consider all the arguments in a liberal manner, adjudicate all the issues reasonably raised, and discuss the relevant evidence, even if you're represented, then what you're looking at when you're not represented under Andrews clearly calls for something more, something higher. And it seems to me...
Robinson is a Q case?
That was my impression, Your Honor, but...
I mean, what you're stating doesn't sound like a Q case.
Sorry, Your Honor, I'm saying that badly. It is not specifically a Q case. It was a case involving whether there was separately a different theory that was raised by the pleadings.
And so our jurisprudence has always held that in the original claims you consider all reasonably raised issues in the claim and or
yes, Your Honor.
Sympathetically read that without regard to its pro se or otherwise.
Yes, Your Honor, but the point that I think is significant from Robinson, and perhaps I'm overreading it, but I think not. It seems to me that Robinson says that you get that much even when you're represented by counsel. And the point that I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is simply that if that's the case, it seems to me that when you're not represented by counsel, there is something more. And it seems to me that Judge Schoen's analysis in the Robinson dissent is closer to where we are when there's not counsel. But we'll
get to that counsel question in just a minute. But
very well.
And Judge Lance's question was whether or not what was pled, whether or not that was specific enough for the cue.
It seemed to me that it was, Your Honor, is the short answer. And I apologize for having gotten a bit far of the mark. The short answer is that if the sympathetic reading applies under Andrews and Roberson, it seems to me that has to be sufficient.
Counselor, if I may.
Yes, sir.
I guess what bothers me is that a citation to a CFR, as we have in this case, as you have pointed out, without fleshing it out further and to provide certain direction or parameters to the theory, would in the future be res judicata to any and all future Q claims of that claimant.
That's
under
true.
That section.
That's true.
That seems to me to have the possibility of doing a great injustice to those who might have several Q claims under a particular section and not requiring them to tell us, at least to give us some roadmaps here as to where this should go, would bar future veterans from all types of causes of action or claims of Q.
Your Honor, certainly that's a possibility, but the problem is that there's no good median point, if I may put it that way. I mean, the difficulty is that I'm sure you've read many of these records. I know I've read a number of them over the years. Many, many of these claims are not stated with great specificity, and that leaves the court two options. You can always say under Andre that it's insufficiently set out to make out a Q claim and send it back and have the person start over. That's always a possibility. But isn't it more reasonable, Your Honor, in cases where a person is not represented, to give them the benefit of the doubt on this sympathetic reading under Andrews and say that that is sufficient to at least generate the issue, particularly where you have, as you do in this case, some actual medical evidence that supports onset during the initial periods. I mean, you have in this case, in 89, during the period of active duty for training, the knee problem in March, you've got the ankle problem with nerve pain radiating into the foot in May. You got this issue of leg cramps in April. And the reason those become significant is that all of those are extremely consistent with the 1995 diagnosis in the Army by Dr. Messier, the neurologist, who talks about the lameness and cramps as being the characteristic symptoms of this particular gentleman's MS. So it's generated by the evidence, even though you don't have a nice, clean, specific reference laid out in the CUE claim. And obviously that would be preferable, Your Honor, but at some point you have to decide how far sympathetic reading reaches. I suggest to you that in a case where you have both supporting medical evidence and a reasonably sufficient raising of the issue, at least citing to the relevant regulation, citing to the statute, that should be sufficient.
Well, your client, with your expert assistance, isn't foreclosed from pursuing that theory at some later time.
That's certainly true.
That's on this hand. On the other hand, we have the issue or the question of a precedential decision of this court and the impact of res judicata by merely citing a CFR section or a statutory section. That's troublesome.
Your Honor, I appreciate that problem, but it's inherent in the system. I mean, no matter how you look at this, most of the records that I've seen that get to the court were not developed by trained attorneys. Sometimes they were developed by very skilled non-attorney NSO representatives. I had the experience of going to Oregon earlier this week to do a BVA remand in a case where I have to say it was the best developed record I've ever seen. It was done by a service rep before I got into the case. But that's the exception, not the rule. I'm sure you've seen enough records by now to know that most of these cases are simply not well set out. And there tend to be boilerplate in the service organization pleadings. There tend to be different service officers handling the case along the way, as you saw here. The arguments are sometimes relatively disjunctive from one filing to the next. And ultimately, of course, you have to decide how far you're willing to reach under the sympathetic reading. Andre, of course, suggests that you can be fairly narrow. Andrews, to the extent it's applicable to CUE cases for non-represented persons, suggests the opposite, and obviously you have to resolve the tension as to where you draw the line. But it does seem to me that it is reasonable where you have someone who's represented by someone other than counsel to look very close at whether the evidence and the CUE pleading at least generate that issue. And it seems to me that in this case, although it may be a close call, it is sufficient to generate that issue. It seems to me that the references to 303, 3.303, and to 1131, together with the medical findings in the service, are sufficient, particularly when you look at the fact that in the decision at 106, in the RO decision, they specifically mention that the 1995 military physicians' findings talk about cramps and lameness as being the hallmark or some of the hallmark medical issues from his MS. It seems to me when you take that all in combination, that's sufficient here. I appreciate that it's not set out with the kind of definitiveness that any of us would like. Personally, I'd like to have a better record, but you know that's how it is. It does seem to me, though, Your Honor, that it passes the test.
Let's move. Unless you have another question on this area, get your thoughts on the whether or not an accredited national service officer is representing a veteran claimant or not. Or is a veteran claimant pro se when he or she is represented, or he or she is, I won't use the word represent, I guess I have to use the word something else, has a national service officer to assist?
You know, I think the answer is that the case law to this point from the Federal Circuit supports the proposition that a person assisted by a national service organization is treated as pro se, And I say that because in Andrews, they were very specific to use the word counsel, not representative, counsel. And if you look at the cases between Roberson and Andrews, specifically at Zemre and Moody, now, Moody, for example, I happen to represent, so I'm familiar with that record, and he was represented by NSOs all the way through. One of the issues that I argued to the Federal Circuit in that case was that because he was represented by an NSO and was not at that time allowed to pay an attorney to represent him, that in fact it would be a denial of due process to hold the NSO pleadings submitted on his behalf to a high standard of pleading. And you'll notice that in Moody, the court ended up characterizing those as pro se pleadings. Similarly, in Zemre, you have a situation where he was represented by AmVets, but again, the court, the Federal Circuit, characterized those pleadings as pro se pleadings. The only time they've taken a different position is Andrews, where they talk specifically about counsel. As you know, Ken Carpenter represented him throughout. And that's the case where they make the distinction. So it seems to me that there is no precedential basis for that. Moreover, Your Honor, the VA system, as you know, was set up at the time the court was created in 88 based on a background of claimants being routinely represented by service organizations. And there is nothing in the enactment in 88 or in the statute since then or regulation since then to suggest that somehow the liberal treatment of those claims should be reduced merely because a person is represented by or assisted by a national service organization. As you know, the regulations provide that a service organization can designate someone who is merely a member, not even a full-time employee, as a representative under the regulations. And it seems to me that given that circumstance, Your Honor, there is really no reasonable basis for the court to treat persons assisted by the national service organizations as represented by counsel within the meaning of Andrews. Does that answer your question?
That's a good answer.
Counsel, I have another question along those lines.
Certainly, Your
Honor. From a jurisprudential perspective, does it make sense to you that the Federal Circuit would draw a line between represented and non-represented appellants?
Quite honestly, no, Your Honor, it doesn't. It seems to me
I'm comforted to hear you say that.
It seems to me, Your Honor, and I mentioned it in the memo, that that's not a reasonable distinction given the whole panoply of VA law and the extraordinary efforts that Congress has made to make that veteran friendly. It seems to me there is not a reasonable basis to carve out some subset of veterans and say you're not going to get the kind of treatment that everyone else gets because you have an attorney. That seems not to be supported.
As I read Roberson, that's not supported at all in the language that the Federal Circuit used in Roberson.
Certainly not in Roberson, Your Honor.
It comes in Simraj and Andrews, of course, it's mentioned there, but it's not supported by statute or regulatory language either, is it?
It does not appear to me to be supported in either of those cases, Your Honor. In fact, as I mentioned in the memorandum, I could see no principled basis for that distinction.
Well, not to get off the subject too much here, but isn't this complicated by the ABA proposed rule, which would not require disclosure of assistance by a licensed attorney of a client? That's presently being reviewed, as I understand it, by the ABA, and that has been proposed.
Your Honor, in all candor, I have not thought through the significance of the proposed rule, but it does seem to me that that would complicate things.
It just seems to me that it creates this artificial application, and I was comforted in this instance to see that the Secretary says that he gives a sympathetic reading to all pleadings of all veterans, so we don't get into these distinctions that may or may not have a difference. But thank you.
Thank you.
I have one other question.
Certainly.
Given everything that you've said, then, and considering all the cases from our court and the Federal Circuit, if you were to give sympathetic reading to a Q motion,
yes, sir,
of a pro se appellant,
yes, sir,
or really, I guess, a claimant, because the appellant now is, quote, purportedly stuck with whatever those pleadings are, if you make a general Q motion, as perhaps you stated here, it seems to be more like a 3.307 Q, but it is about service connection.
Yes, sir.
So there's a duty to sympathetically read that pleading, and VA then would be required to determine all possible ways based on that pleading that they may have made a clear and unmistakable error in the case?
I don't think it goes that far, Your Honor. I think it's more closely analogous to where Judge Scholin was going in Robinson, which is, as I read it, that you would have to look at the facts that are raised, and let me see if I can quickly find
my note. I'm talking about Q now.
I understand, Your Honor. I'm suggesting that by analogy, Your Honor. In Robinson, she talked about considering the circumstances, the type of disability, and the evidence of record. And it seems to me that's a reasonable analysis or a basis for analysis for a sympathetic reading case in CUE as well. The difference, it seems to me, between the unrepresented and the represented claimant is simply that when you have a represented claimant, you can reasonably expect a fairly detailed articulation of the claim, although I know there are exceptions. But it also seems to me that with an unrepresented claimant, Your Honor, the fact that they've generated the issue at all really has to be treated as sufficient, just because what you're going to do otherwise, as Judge Lance really pointed out earlier, is to effectively put all these cases back through requiring the person to come back with a new Q claim.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Government?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Michael Carr. I'm representing the Secretary today, and to my right is Joan Moriarty. She's Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Mr. Carr, that podium adjusts, okay, if you'd be more comfortable with it up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yeah. Good afternoon, Your Honors. Again, my name is Michael Carr. The position of the Secretary is that the CUE theory alleged before the Board is different from that which was alleged before the Court, and that, therefore, the appeal should be dismissed. As well known, a motion for revision on the basis of CUE must be pled with specificity, and a specific allegation of CUE must first be the subject of a final Board decision. And in this case, the theory alleged before the Court here that CUE was alleged on the basis of 1131 is different from which that was alleged below on the presumptive basis, 3.307.
Let me pick up something.
Yes.
If you were to sympathetically read a Q motion and discern all potential claims therein, and you do that and then you address the Q motion on the merits but fail to address one of those things that had been discerned, does that under DeShotto become denied?
Well, in this case, it is the Secretary's position that this theory alleged now could not have been discerned.
But just answer that question. Would the result be that a decision on that particular issue of Q be denied?
It would be.
Or would it be one where it would be required to have been addressed by the adjudicator?
I think in that case it would not have been addressed by the adjudicator, if it was never the subject of a RO or thereafter a board decision, Your Honor. And in this case, it is the Secretary's position that looking at the pleadings, in particular, the March 2003 claim, the April 2003 notice of disagreement, the February 2004 settlement appeal, including the statement which was alluded to by opposing counsel regarding the statute or the, pardon me, the regulation noted, it was noted 3.303. But I think if you look at all these pleadings, you have what you'll find are specific allegations of CUE based on whether or not the veteran had qualifying service and therefore would have met the requirements on a presumptive service connection under 3.307 and 3.309. In contrast to that, what you find in the record are general statements, references to, yes, 1131 and 3.303, but nothing more. And I think if there was any doubt regarding these pleadings, which Secretary's position is there should not have been, that doubt would have been extinguished upon a reading of the board hearing transcript in September 2005. In that hearing transcript, it's very clear what the CUE theory was below. And if I may, a couple poignant quotations. Your Honors, record at page 166, you'll find the representative states the arguments the veteran is qualifying service for 3.307A1, and the representative continues to argue that the veteran meets the 90-day requirement. On the following page, record at 167, you'll find that he's arguing that it never preexisted, he had no symptoms whatsoever until after 1990. We clearly believe that all the evidence in this file clearly shows that service connection should be established for multiple sclerosis. It meets the qualifying, essentially, service, and therefore VA should grant service connection under 3.309. And that's at record 167. And finally, at 164, or pardon me, Your Honors, record at 174, you'll find a statement. He definitely had the qualifying service. That's where we contend the CUE exists. But it is the contention of the Secretary that the pleadings show clearly illustrate that, and then this, on top of that, if there was any doubt, would have extinguished that doubt. And it's clear that that was the theory of CUE alleged below, and properly that was the theory that was adjudicated by the board.
So, counsel, your position is that record at 106 does not reasonably raise a does not reasonably raise a Q claim, is that, or Q request, is that accurate? I said 106.
Yeah, that's the rating decision, Your Honor.
Yeah. It was the, I'm sorry, it was record at 140.
Okay. Yes, this was the, Your Honor, this was the actual VA Form 9 that was attached to the representative statement. And again, I think this is consistent with the other pleadings, in that if you look at it, basically says I've met all the requirements pertaining to the regulations, and he does state generally the regs, but then he says specifically the MS that I have is covered under 3.307A1, and I think that is consistent with the other pleadings as being specific as to what the error was, whereas you just have a general statement. And I think even assuming for argument's sake that this veteran should have been considered pro se, you look at cases like Kennedy versus Nicholson, and it's clear what you have to look at is the specificity of the actual CUE alleged. And as Judge Lance noted, if you overbroadly read something and determine there's a claim where there wasn't one raised, race judicata would set in. And in this case, looking at this, I think it's clear that you have to show, and looking at Kennedy versus Nicholson in addition, that you have to show minimally what the error was and how it would have changed the outcome. And with regard to the presumptive service connection theory alleged, that was done with sufficient specificity, the Secretary contends, and it was adjudicated by the board. For instance, the argument, the error, pardon me, Your Honors, was that he did have qualifying service. That was the error. How that would have manifestly changed the outcome would be if he did have the qualifying service, he would have met the requirements for the presumptive service connection under 3.307 and 3.309 for multiple sclerosis. So that does meet the threshold. And, you know, even assuming, again, that you should have been treated as pro se, it's true, as in Robinson, the secretary submitted supplemental pleading in that case, and it was actually noted in the decision that VA does treat all pleadings sympathetically, regardless of represented status. And there's no indication that there was any deviation from that in this case.
What exactly does it mean that the VA treats all pleadings sympathetically? What does the VA do in that regard?
Well, I think opposing counsel indicated this too. Essentially, you look for all potential claims in a reading of the pleadings. And I believe in that case here, it's inherent in this that they did discern the CUE theory based on the presumptive service connection, Your Honor. And that's the theory that was alleged with specificity. It's clear, and again, I'll cite to, pardon me, Your Honor, the case of Brown versus West essentially says that, you know, the VA is not required to engage in prognostication or anticipate claims when they're not reasonably raised or there's no intention to raise it. And I think, again, that gets back to the comment by Judge Lance in that reading something, teasing, pleading out, if you will, and trying to get a reading out of it that wasn't intended could potentially be detrimental to a veteran. And in this case, there is no indication from the record here that there was a deviation from the VA practice, which is to read all pleadings sympathetically, and again, regardless of represented status.
Well, give me an example. Let's see. To read all pleadings sympathetically, and of course, the Federal Circuit has said that we now read Q motions sympathetically.
That's correct.
And had the government always read Q motions sympathetically?
Well, I think that, again, all pleadings are read sympathetically, but again, the fact that you read something sympathetically doesn't detract from, or pardon me, set aside the inherent requirements of a CUE. I mean, that is at its basis.
Okay. And what are the specific requirements of a Q motion?
Q motion, Your Honor. Essentially, minimally, I think you have to, it requires a degree of specificity that would permit one to understand the assertion of error and also how that would have changed the outcome. And again, I'll contrast the theory alleged before the court with that which is below and how you can look at the theory that was adjudicated by the board and see, okay, this is the error. And had this not been made or had this not been determined, he would have received service connection. That's how the outcome would have manifestly changed. And I think minimally you at least have to show what the error is. And I don't think looking at these pleadings, a general
How if that error had not been made, there would have been a different outcome?
Correct. I don't think you can read from just a general statement that service connection requires. And then,
so is there any pleading in this case that addresses outcome?
With regard to the theory alleged here before the court, the secretary's position is no, there's not. You cannot discern a CUE theory based on 1131 by reading the record, and it's not clear from the record. No, you couldn't discern that. That's the secretary's position.
What about the medical documents that appellant's counsel referred to?
Your Honor. Initially, I do have to stress that none of these records were ever referenced in the principal brief or even after the secretary filed his brief in the reply brief. Having said that, Your Honor, the position is that that argument's been abandoned. However, having said that, Your Honor, I will say that looking at a few service records now, I think in the supplemental pleading, Your Honor, it was addressed. But looking at that now and making an argument that these relate back to the multiple sclerosis, that's not consistent with the record itself, or I believe it was a Dr. Gilbert was the doctor that submitted statements diagnosing the multiple sclerosis and noting the onset of symptoms, which he said was sometime in 1990, I think. And so there was nothing relating the symptoms that he had in service to the diagnosis that he made years later. There's just nothing in the record relating these two anywhere. And so in that regard, I don't think you can look at service records that were not referenced in any way in connection with direct service connection alone to say that this constitutes a CUE theory on that basis.
Let me ask you the same question I asked appellant's counsel regarding the jurisprudence with Roberson and Andrews. Do you have a perspective on that you care to share?
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, as laid out in my supplemental pleading, I, Secretary, took the position that looking at the realities and looking at the regs, that there are certain distinctions, obvious distinctions between a veteran who appears truly pro se and someone who is represented, well, pardon the characterization, by a veteran service organization. There are obvious distinctions in the regs that I cited in supplemental pleading address that. But again, I also did emphasize in supplemental pleading that having said all that, we, this meaning VA, read all pleadings sympathetically regardless. You know, obviously this is a question, there is a gap, and essentially that's why we're here today. You have Roberson, you have Andrews, and I can only offer this, that it would not be unprecedented to find, if you will, a middle ground or a hybrid. One would only need to look at the EJ jurisprudence and look at non-attorney practitioners and the distinctions they make between non-attorney practitioners and attorneys. But again, having said all that, I want to really emphasize that as we set forth in Robinson, we read all pleadings sympathetically.
Counselor, I'm fascinated by the Chief's question relative to they show tell that the Federal Circuit put out for the theory, I guess, of sub silentio denial of claims. And it just seems to me that the issues that we're addressing here today and that doctrine are on a collision course at some point in time when the VA says, yes, we looked at this section as cited by the appellant. We've looked at every possible aspect of it, and that's it. I mean, if nothing further is done, I guess that's a sub silentio denial according to the Federal Circuit, and the clock starts to run, and the veteran still doesn't know exactly what the VA is thinking. But that's an editorial comment. I guess what we're wrestling with here right now is this threshold that you alluded to. And how much the veteran or his representative or her representative needs to do in order to at least put the VA on notice that there's something going on here. And finding that threshold, I think, is really what this is all about. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, in this case, had the veteran said, I understand that presumptively I may not be entitled to anything, but I think, as a matter of direct service connection, I should be awarded at least a hearing on my condition and an examination of the medical records, period. Now, what he hasn't said was, and I think that might change the outcome of your decision. Would that be enough in your opinion?
I think if I understood the question correctly, if he were to have said, I may not be warranted service connection on a presumptive basis, but I think I might be entitled on a direct basis, and then he requests a hearing or development of the claim.
I might be entitled to it on a direct basis, period.
Looking again, Your Honor, I think looking at Kennedy and even, butchering the pronunciation, Smirage, that case, it lays out that you do need to have at least show what the difference in the outcome would have been. And I think saying, I think I might be entitled to service connection on a direct basis. In this context, and especially in the context of the CUE, I'm not sure how that would say what the error was in the underlying R decision here in April 2000 and how what that error, had it not been made, would have changed the outcome. So I think absent that, but again...
But changing the outcome, isn't that a lot to ask of a pro se veteran? I mean... He or she might know that there's a presumption, as was initially pled in this case, and he or she may know that there could be direct service connection. But how all that fits together in changing outcomes, isn't that a little complex for a run-of-the-mill veteran to comprehend?
Your Honor, I think keeping it in the context of CUE I think inherent in any motion for revision based on CUE, those are basic requirements, but I agree that maybe, trying to think about an example, Your Honor, maybe where he would say, for example, yes, I think I might be entitled to direct service connection, and here's why, and then say, this record here, I have a record in service which shows that I had this condition and that wasn't considered, or something of that nature, I would imagine. But I think minimally you do need to put VA on notice as to what the error was, how that would have affected the claim or changed the outcome.
And I guess to put this in a context of sports, how far does the veteran have to carry the ball before he hands it to the secretary?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, that would be a case-by-case basis, depending on the facts of the case. But again, I think here, when you look at the pleadings, just simply stating the statute, that's certainly not enough. The secretary would contend that wouldn't be enough to, if you will, pass the ball off to the secretary. Simply a general statement saying service connection, it means this, and then citing to a regulation or a statute, that I don't think would be enough. And that's essentially the situation we have here in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So it is the position that this theory is different from that which was alleged below, and accordingly the case is dismissed.
One other question, sure. I think. Counsel for Mr. Osceola indicated that the RO didn't, I may be stating this wrong, but I'm going to state it, did not rule on direct service connection. Is that correct?
If I may...
If he did not rule on direct service connection and you don't take the DeShottle approach, then there is no final decision on the question of direct service connection. Mm-hmm.
Just for a clarification, Your Honor, are you referring to the underlying April 2000 decision?
Well, there's got to be Q of something. So
yeah.
If you file a Q motion, what's the final decision that you're filing Q on?
I think.
Or is this simply the reasons or basis question?
I think if you look at that decision, and this record at 99, mm-hmm. page 99, Your Honor, the board does at least address that. If you look at the next to last paragraph, it says there's no evidence that the veteran's multiple sclerosis originated during a period of qualifying military service. The veteran's active duty for training is not sufficient to trigger the presumptive provisions shown above. So they do make a finding that there's no evidence that it originated during a period of qualifying service. And that would, in essence, I think, address a direct connection. And it's the Secretary's position that, in this case, given that the Secretary finds that there was no such theory alleged below, that the veteran would be free to go ahead and file a motion provision based on CUE on the basis of 1131. Certainly free to do that if he so chose, Your Honor.
So your position is that the court does not have jurisdiction at this point. And actually, if that's the case, then there's no need to reach the question of the VSO representation issue or the sympathetic reading. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that the court doesn't have jurisdiction over this theory. And again, it's the Secretary's position that you could not discern from the pleadings or from the record as a whole that this was alleged below. So therefore, it's not been the subject of a final board decision. Correct. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Jackson, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to focus on your question about the shuttle. I think there's a distinction. I had the misfortune of doing the shuttle at the Federal Circuit.
You did that, huh?
I did, okay. For which I have regretted. But in any event, the shuttle makes the point that the reason that the VA can consider one issue as denied is that there are multiple issues that the veteran knows are pending, and the Federal Circuit says if you know that multiple issues are pending and one of them is decided, the others are implicitly denied. I don't think you can get there in the CUE context because, as you put it in your question, you can never tell, excuse me, that the issue was discerned because it was not discussed. So there's not a way for you to have a case where the issue is both discerned but not discussed and therefore held to be denied. I mean, in DeShottle, the mechanism that you're working with is that you have multiple claims pending. I mean, we can go to the record and we can say, okay, this claim was filed, this claim was filed, this claim was filed. So each of those has been discerned for purposes of that question. And therefore, when there's a denial under DeShottle, you can say, all right, these three claims are pending, this one is discussed, this one's discussed, this third one's not discussed, but we have to assume it's denied. In the CUE context, because of the nature of CUE, as you were talking about both with me and with opposing counsel, you can't get there. There's no way that the claim gets discerned without being discussed. So I don't think you can have that problem coming back at us, at least.
Because we've always, I mean, the jurisprudence has always said it, the queue is a specific type of
That's correct, Your
Honor. Process. And in fact, the Federal Circuit endorsed that in Andre.
They did.
Clearly laying out it was not like a claim for benefits.
That is correct, Your Honor.
It subsumes those kinds of things, and it's a specific error that has to be alleged.
That's all correct, Your Honor, and that's what makes Andrews so difficult to reconcile with the other cases, is trying to figure out what the proper parameters of a sympathetic reading of a Q claim are in the context of Andre's requirement that you have specificity. And all I can suggest, Your Honor, is it seems to me that it is fairly reasonable and somewhat workable to adopt the bright line test that if you cite the appropriate regulation or statute, you are assumed to have raised the issues that are generated by those. And I understand Judge Lance's concern that that may be overbroad, but mechanically it's very difficult to find a better test without at the same time abandoning the sympathetic reading obligation. It's very difficult to find any other central point, if you will.
You sympathetically read specific requirements?
That's what it says, Judge.
Yeah, okay.
You know, we all have to work in the context of what we're given. Your Honor, if you have no other questions, I appreciate the time, and for the reasons discussed, we do ask that the court remands it to the BVA.
Questions? All right, the case is submitted. We will greet counsel at the bar and then adjourn.
All
Likewise.